I'm Duncan MacLeod. Mark Todes is my guest on TechCentral's TCS Legends today. But before I introduce you to him, I need to mention our sponsor, without whom we wouldn't be able to bring you these great interviews. TCS Legends is powered by Mitel. For all your unified communication and customer experience needs, you really should visit mitel.com. Please go and check out their website. Now, Mark Todes may be familiar to people for a number of reasons, but he's probably best known for leading a fight or co-leading a fight against Telkom's attempts in the 1990s to monopolize the internet in South Africa. Along with David Frankel, another recent guest on TCS Legends, he co-chaired the Internet Service Providers Association that fought Telkom's attempts to claim exclusivity over the internet protocol in the late 1990s. But there's a lot more to Mark's career as well, and it's a fascinating story. So, Mark, it's really good to see you after so long. Thank you for flying up to our studio here in Johannesburg and for the chat, and welcome.
Duncan, thank you very much. Really, when you reached out to me, I was really very chuffed. You know, I remember you being part of that amazing period, actually, in the 90s when I first met you, and you were at Times Media, I think.
Yes.
FM. And you were always one of the good guys, I have to say. So, we did indeed have some interesting times then. But you've had an august group of people that have been that you've interviewed in this series.
Yes, and I think we're going to have to do a season two as well.
I'm sure there are dozens more. Yeah. Some, you know, I'm not sure that I consider myself a legend, but I'm very honored to be in the group. So thank you. And I've worked with so many of them, actually. It's been an amazing time.
I'm really looking forward to catching up and talking about some of those developments.
Sure.
Some of them which predate my time covering the industry. So maybe we should start there. Let's maybe look back to when you started. What was the business called originally?
It was CompuStat.
CompuStat. Yeah. You started that basically out of university in the 1970s.
1976. Mm-hmm. My good friend and colleague and longstanding business partner, Mendel Karpel, and I were postgraduate students in the civil engineering faculty at UCT. And sitting on the steps of what is now the Sarah Bartman Hall, contemplating what we may or may not do to make some pocket money, you know.
Okay.
And we came up, we had done one course in computing. We learned how to program in Fortran.
Wow.
On the UNIVAC mainframe at UCT. There was no personal computing in those days.
Fortran was a huge language.
It was. No object-oriented coding. Mm-hmm. You know, it was all just looping and calls.
Was that the days of punch cards?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. IBM punch cards. Mm-hmm. And so we, I think the way it, if I remember correctly, my father, who was a general practitioner back in Zimbabwe, where we both came from, had recently had his whole practice put onto computer.
Okay.
That was the phrase. And I was chatting to Mendel about it, and we said, computerized statements. So CompuStat. So we walked down to Rondebosch. Main Road Rondebosch and into Rustenburg Pharmacy. That was the student pharmacy there. And we went to the manager, a chap by the name of Gerald Musikanth, said to him, we'd like to put your accounts onto computer for you. Would you be interested? So he was amazing, actually. We owe him a lot because he said to us, look, I've actually been on a bureau service for almost 2 years already, but I like to help students. And if you guys can replicate what this bureau are doing for me, I'll make a switch. So that is how we started. We walked out of the pharmacy and across the road to Nedbank, and we opened a bank account in the name of CompuStat. Mendel and I argue about how much we each put in. I think it was about 100 rand each. Mm-hmm. And that's how we started, October 1976.
This pharmacy was your first client?
The pharmacy was our first client. And on the back of that, we developed a bureau-based accounting system to manage their accounts. Yeah, the second amazing thing, honestly, when I think back to it, geez, it was wonderful. There was a large firm of engineering consultants in Cape Town, mm-hmm. one of the leading firms, VKE, Funika, Klein & Edwards. CEO of VKE was a guy called Johan Boer. And we had done a little bit of work for him as students. And we went to see him because they had recently acquired a DEC mini computer, mm-hmm. one of the first in the country, actually. Mm-hmm. Told him what we were trying to do, and he said to us, use that machine with pleasure at night, free reign. And he gave us keys to their offices. And so the two of us used to go up there at night, and we developed this package, bureau package, and then we drove up and down Main Road in Cape Town looking for other pharmacies that would come on board. And we eventually even found a couple of industrial companies, some packaging companies and so on. So that was the
What were you
building
this on at the time?
Really, on this out of Fortran, mm-hmm. using punch cards and on this DEC computer, this mini, DEC mini, yeah.
So did each pharmacy have to have one of these mini DEC minis?
No. So it was a bureau.
It was a bureau service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we ran, that's a good question, a good point. So we ran the service on, because there was no personal computing.
Yes.
That didn't exist in those days. So any company that wanted to have their accounts or whatever it was, computer-based. Mm-hmm. So there were dot matrix printers, of course. But we ran a service, essentially.
Yeah. Okay. A bit like the modern, equivalent then to modern cloud computing, I suppose.
Well, isn't it ironic that we've got that circle in a way?
Yeah.
Yeah, except, of course, in those days, those firms didn't have direct access at all. Mm-hmm.
So how did it actually work? How did they get the data from the pharmacy onto that machine?
We used to collect they used to store their invoices and their paperwork mm-hmm. in a Kalamazoo-based physical file, actually, cardboard, alphabetically. We used to collect those from them once a month. We took them to a punch card service on the top of the Caltex building in downtown Cape Town. We used to hand it in. They used to punch the cards for us based on these invoices. They would go through them. We gave them the codes to use. We would collect the punch cards and go up to the top of VKE onto the DEC and then run.
Very manual.
No, it was very manual. And in fact, another nice story is that one day I went to collect the punch cards from the service, came back to VKE. Mendel was busy working and setting things up there. So they had one of those cake lifter hard drives, which I think the capacity of them was, I'm not sure if it was a meg,
one meg,
one thereabouts. I forget now. But anyway.
I remember IBM had something large like that.
Yes.
I think it had a 5 megabyte.
Yeah, well, there you go. It was round and looked like a cake lifter tin.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Anyway, and tape input as well, of course. Mm-hmm. So I collected the punch cards from the service, went to VKE into the offices, walking up the stairs to the offices where Mendel was busy. And I had the cards in my hand and I tripped on the staircase and the cards fell out onto the staircase. Now, the problem was that our program, our software, was reliant on the cards being in the right order.
Oh,
now they weren't in an order. And honestly, so we sat down and said, well, we need to write a sort routine for this package of ours. So that was one of the first challenges, simply because the cards were no longer in the right order. So.
Amazing.
Anyway, those were the challenges in the beginning. And it was fun. You know,
so
in the era before
take
personal
us how the
computing.
Business evolved from there. You eventually developed a word processor.
Yeah. So the era of personal computing followed very quickly thereafter.
Mm.
And I know you were talking to Joan about this, Joan Joffe, the point, because personal computing snuck around the corner and took everybody by surprise, including IBM, as Joan said.
Yes.
So Hewlett-Packard released early generation computers, personal computers, that initially weren't DOS-based, but of course later on with MS-DOS, the emergence, that's where we all went.
Mm.
But so actually, in fact, our first personal computing software was something that Mendel developed, was a fully-fledged system for land surveyors.
Oh, yes.
Actually, to do plotting of cadastral maps, diagrams, working in conjunction with the Surveyor General. There it was a hybrid thing because we sold the land surveyors the software that we'd written together with first generation, small little HP PC.
Mm-hmm.
The software was written in BASIC, if I remember correctly. Mendel will correct me on that. But what they would do is they would create the diagrams necessary on the software, bring in a disk to our offices in Pinelands and Cape Town, and then we had large HP plotters.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ran a bureau service to produce the diagrams, to plot the diagrams for them, because those plotters were big and expensive. And we sold that very widely, actually. So that was really effectively our second product. The word processing thing, that became our flagship. And in the 80s, that was probably what we were known for best.
On DOS initially.
It was on DOS. So it was a DOS-based. And what happened was working with our third partner, I think I mentioned the likes of Roland Bryan. He was our prof. He was our CTO.
Okay.
He was our tech guru. We also had David Hannon, who was a fellow engineer with us, and Dave Stegman, who actually ran the computer center at UCT, the UNIVAC. Oh, So the five of us were really the board. I should mention others. You know, my brother joined the firm early on and has been working with me ever since. What a privilege to work with my brother, Daniel, for nearly 40 years. And I can add to that that I met my wife at CompuStat. She was one of the early CompuStatters, and you know, we've been married for over 30 years. So it is an amazing breeding ground of opportunities.
So why did you decide to develop a word processor?
Yeah, so Ghostwriter, we called the word processor Ghostwriter.
What year was this, by the way?
So 1983-84.
Was WordPerfect out at the time?
No. Oh, your WordPerfect, say, it's a good question. Yeah. So we ended up competing with Multimate, WordStar, and
WordStar,
if you remember it, and then latterly WordPerfect. Mm-hmm. But no MS Word yet. Mm-hmm. That came later. So the point of this was, first of all, actually, remember DOS was text-based on the screen,
yes.
Still green screen, but we worked out how to work with proportional-spaced fonts on a screen and do proper wrapping even when you needed to be full justified. Mm. So that was and personal computing was now offering more than just computational solutions. You know, these were now business solutions. Mm. The notion of a word processor as opposed to an IBM typewriter or those big Wang word processors that were heavy machines, that a word processor could be on a PC. That was brand new. And the other thing that happened was that Hewlett-Packard released their first laser printers in the early 80s. And we wrote a driver for those laser printers. So we got onto the bandwagon very early. We had this bundle of Ghostwriter, which was written in a language called Forth.
Remember Forth?
Forth, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Ghostwriter became a fully fledged word processing system that harnessed the laser printer. And we sold it as a bundle, mostly to law firms, those were our, but quite a few corporates. Mm-hmm. Shell South Africa adopted Ghostwriter as well. And in the end, we actually had several hundred law firms in the country, all using thousands of users of Ghostwriter with this bundle. I mean, amongst the first things that they realized was that they no longer needed pre-printed stationery. Mm-hmm. Because the laser printer could even do their logos and diagrams and, you know, make documents look pretty and so on. So, I don't know. We stumbled into it. And for us, from that time on, from the early 80s, a document became something digital. Mm-hmm. We developed, if I can get a little technical, we developed a DOM, a document object model, which was ours. And it was a digital representation of a document. And what we did was, now we started developing vertical apps into that word processing arena. And actually, the fun thing about Ghostwriter as we had developed it was that we actually created it with two programming languages within Ghostwriter. So we had an interpreter, which we just called Ghostwriter Interpreter. But we also had a compiler in Ghostwriter, which we called Ghosttech. Mm-hmm. And that enabled us to develop vertical apps. It was a rapid application development environment. So the first app that we developed, we did in conjunction with some attorneys from what was then Cliff Decker and Todd, now Cliff Decker. Mm-hmm. Hugh Jackson was the leading conveyancing partner there. And he worked with us to develop a system for conveyances, for property transfers. Mm-hmm. And we called that Ghost Convey. By this stage, the Ghost moniker was sticking to our, mm-hmm. Ghostwriter, we just thought was a good name for a word processor. We, as you seen and heard, we kept the name Ghost and a number of later products. But so we created Ghost Convey, and that really became a very rich, fully fledged conveyancing system that eventually handled the entire community, actually, of property transfer. So it did all the transfer documents. It automated them. So we wrote an app that would automate the compilation of the documents with the right paragraphs in the right places and the right names and variables and conditional logic and so on around it. So that became our expertise, is authoring templates that mm-hmm. could be used to produce documents. Mm-hmm. And to this day, actually, that's still our kind of flagship expertise. Mm-hmm. Ghost Convey, in the end, I'm going to track you forward until 2016 when we sold it to LexisNexis. At that point in time, over 90% of all transfers that were registered at the deeds office in South Africa were done on Ghost Convey.
Wow.
Yeah. So it really became a dominant product in the marketplace.
Did it gain traction in international markets as well?
Because it's very local to the South African conveyancing market. Ghost Writer did, and later, well, we'll talk a bit about second generation product, which we called Ghost Fill.
Yeah.
But just to finish off on the Ghost Writer side of things, apart from selling this bundle to firms of attorneys for word processing, we started adding these vertical products. Convey was really our flagship, but we had a bunch of others. We had a company secretarial one and intellectual property one and a litigation, Ghost Litigation, Ghost COSEC. These were all modules in the word processing environment where the central element of what was needed was to produce documents.
Yes.
But we built workflow around them using the rapid application development environment that I talk about. Mm-hmm. And so they became kind of mini ecosystems in and of themselves. One of the important add-ons early in the 90s now, there were two that were kind of flagship add-ons. I mean, I hope you don't mind if I just roll
please,
on with these things.
Do. Yeah.
There were two that are worth mentioning. I want to talk about, we developed an email module for this DOS-based word processor. We called it Ghost Mail.
What year was this?
Early 90s, okay. 1991, mm-hmm. right? And that was astonishing for many reasons. First of all, our users were using Ghost Writer in a Novell networking environment. Novell had protocols for wide area networking, and in particular, using dial-up modems for data transfer. And so we developed this module in Ghost Writer that enabled the users to email documents amongst themselves, as long as they all had the same environment.
On the net Novell.
And on the Novell, on the backbone, the Novell backbone. And so two things. First of all, that experience that we got in transferring data via modems was kind of a natural segue for us into the internet world, which is still coming.
Sure.
But a couple of other bits and pieces that came out of that. One is that, I remember a nice story from early on. Once Ghostmail became part of what lawyers were starting to use, you know, and in those days, the notion of email was brand new. Mm. It was brand new.
Well, we had Mike Laurie on the
Did you? So the Mike show. Laurie's a nice fellow. Yeah. Fantastic. Okay, and, so another good guy to have.
He brought
yeah.
the internet to South Africa.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
But before he actually did that, he was working, doing pioneering work around email between universities.
Correct, correct. At academic level.
Yeah.
And I say, what a great guy. So I actually haven't seen that episode, but geez, respect for Mike Laurie, absolutely. So one of the early stories that vindicated our journey into this whole email exercise was when the Achille Lauro sank off the coast of KwaZulu-Natal, yes. actually. There was a law firm in Durban called Shepston Wiley, a big law firm that were using Ghost Writer. They were established, and they needed to draft affidavits very quickly. Mm-hmm. And then the expertise in marine law amongst the advocates was in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. And they discovered that they could email documents backwards and forwards, you know, and that was a revelation for mm-hmm. them. It was a nice practical application of the usefulness of email.
Yes.
In a world where people were used to sending faxes in a way. But
this was still DOS, right?
Yes.
One doesn't really associate DOS and email.
No, absolutely not. I agree. But so I'll tell you about two vertical apps that came out of the Ghost Writer, Ghost Mail platform that we had built. These were apps that we developed also in the Ghost Writer, Ghost Tech application development environment. So it was our own coding. I suppose you could equivalent to kind of scripting today. Although Ghost Tech was a compiler, so we could build our own functions. Mm-hmm. two of interest. One was that in, I think about 1988, one of our colleagues came to us, a guy called Anton van Dorsten, spoke about an opportunity to do full text searching in Ghostwriter of large volumes of text. So this is long before Google, right? Mm-hmm. So we developed a full text search engine in Ghostwriter. And we went to see the folks at Juta, who were the publishers of the law in this country, of the statutes. And cut a long story short, we went into a joint venture partnership with Juta. We called it Juta Stat, a combination of CompuStat mm-hmm. and Juta. And we put all of the South African statutes and the law reports and the tax reports all onto CD-ROM. And actually we were one of the first CD-ROM publishers.
Okay.
You know, so Duncan, I must just say at this stage, I mean, I don't want to come across as if I'm bragging too much. You know?
No, not at all.
Because we just had so many of these fun projects. Yeah. Sorry, I'll cut you off here.
Absolutely fascinating. Yeah. I mean, was it technically quite an achievement to build a search engine into this product?
Well, if you ask Prof. Roland, he said, no, you know, we had text. We had our own DOM, of course, and we stored text mm-hmm. in the word processing environment. So it's all about bits and bytes. But for us, I mean, it was certainly novel, right? Mm-hmm. We went to a CD-ROM conference in New York around about that time. And I think there were 7 or 8 participants. When we went to that same conference a year later, the list of participants was on a CD-ROM. But remember, you know, the capacity of a CD-ROM, if I remember correctly, was about 600 meg. You know, so still.
Yeah. I remember, you know, a couple of years there in the early 1990s where CD-ROMs were huge.
Yes, exactly.
Things like Microsoft Encarta.
Yes, exactly.
That was the big one. Yeah.
Right. So this text search engine was the key. Mm. And the notion that people in legal practice, so remember we were selling these bundles to lawyers. And so it was a natural progression for us to say to legal practitioners who were using Ghostwriter, that we could give them a product where they could search the law, the statutes, and importantly, the law report. Mm-hmm. So interestingly, by the way, once Juta's agreed to go, we went 50-50 into a joint venture with Juta's to produce this product called JutaStat. Juta's were the publishers of the law reports. That was a much bigger volume. I mean, talking about, if I remember correctly, about 200,000 pages of text, you know, that needed to be captured because it was in print format. Mm-hmm. The statutes were less, and we started with the statutes. And what we did was that we employed a whole lot of housewives, literally, in Cape Town. We gave them Ghostwriter, and we gave them the printed version of the statutes, and we told them to type them up. Mm-hmm. And every page was done 2 or 3 times by different people, and then we wrote a doc compare solution in Ghostwriter looking for the errors. And that's how we got, because we needed to have 99.9% accuracy and so on. Mm-hmm. So another interesting thing was that at that time, the statutes, the license for producing the South African statutes actually belonged to Butterworths, not Juta's. Mm-hmm. So Butterworth sued us for producing this digital version. And the counter argument, which we eventually won, so they claimed that they owned the right to the statutes. So, of course, the counter-argument is, first of all, no one owns the rights to the statutes. They belong to the nation. They owned the publishing rights for the print version of the statutes, and we were producing a digital version. Mm-hmm. Well, they thought we had somehow copied their print version and had some magical copy. And they didn't realize that we had retyped them. Mm-hmm. But when they sued us, they spoke about the deliberate markers, you know, the odd that they place into the print version for copyright purposes. When they looked at our text version, those markers weren't there, obviously, because they didn't. So, you know, they lost the case. It was an interesting challenge. The notion of text, such huge volumes of text being available digitally, was new then.
Yeah. But you were a real pioneer in that CD-ROM business. Were you the first guys doing it in South Africa?
I think so. So another interesting thing, just very quickly on these stories, but when it came to doing the law reports now, the volume there was about 5 or 6 times more than the statutes. Duters came to us, our partners, and said, look, there's a crowd in the UK that have developed very advanced OCR technology, and they can automate this process rather than doing it manually with people here in Cape Town. They've given us a quote for this thing. Let's ship it to them, and they'll do the whole job for us. So maybe a little bit against our better judgment, that's what happened. A couple of months later, I was sitting at my desk in Cape Town. Phone rings. It was a long-distance call. You could, in those days, you could hear, you know, as a long-distance exchange was clicking in. And a gentleman came online with an obviously difficult accent for me to absorb initially. He introduced himself and said that he was from a company in China that had got the job from this company in the UK, and they were employing housewives in China to do the typing up of exactly what we'd been. That was the sophisticated OCR solution. So anyway, you know, it happened. He had some questions to ask us about formatting and so on.
You also received a phone call in the early 90s from Microsoft. Tell us about that.
I mentioned that to you earlier, So similar, you know, the long-distance phone call sitting at my desk one day. Someone came on with a thick American accent, which I won't try to imitate. But he wanted to know if I was Mr. Todis and from CompuStat. And he said, you are the owners and holders of a product called Ghostwriter, and you have the copyright to the name Ghostwriter. So I said, yes, that's correct. He said, well, I'm phoning you from the Microsoft Corporation in Seattle, Washington. You might have heard of us, he said. He said, I'm phoning to tell you that we are going to use the name Ghostwriter for a product that we're going to be launching.
That must have gone down like a
Can you imagine? Those were his words. So, and I kind of processed that and said, say what? So he said, well, and so this is the point that you mentioned earlier. Microsoft had recently released Word and were in the first stages, I think, if I remember correctly, of bundling that together with early versions of Excel and into a product called Office. So the first versions of Office. And it turns out that they had decided, in order to attract youngsters to use Word, they were going to, based on the popularity of the Ghostbusters movie franchise at that time, they were going to release an add-on to Word, which they were going to call Ghostwriter. And I think it featured Ghostbusters characters or
Microsoft did some very odd things.
No, So I'm happy to say it wasn't long-lived because we couldn't fight them. He said to me, I mean, listen, I don't want to, you know, knock Microsoft. We have a lot of respect for Microsoft, always have had. And today we're a SaaS provider in the Azure cloud. So, you know, we're not by any means
anti-Microsoft.
But that was at a time, actually, just before Bill Gates had to go and defend Microsoft and for their shenanigans with Netscape, and we'll talk about that in a while. But so I doubt whether they would do it today. But he did say to me, Mr. Todis, what I can say to you is, if you do want to litigate against us, that's fine. I'm phoning from the legal department of Microsoft. We're used to litigating. We've got many cases going, and we can hold this up for a long time. It would be a costly exercise for you. So why don't you consider just letting us do this?
Did they offer you any compensation?
Well, I mean, look, we weren't interested, you know, but I kind of fished out there. So at one stage he said, well, we don't really have any budget to give you money for this. You know, so, not that we were necessarily looking for it. He said, but I'll tell you what we will do as a gesture of appreciation is we will make you guys gold partners of Microsoft. So I was upset by that for a couple of reasons. First of all, we were already gold partners anyway. We obviously didn't know that. But secondly, to me, that debased the gold partnership program, you know, because it meant something to be a gold partner. He was prepared to just make us gold partners. So I don't know what authority he may or may not have had to offer that to us within the Microsoft. So anyway, it was an interesting time.
And you just leave it?
Left it. Yeah. You know what? I think that they did give us, if I remember correctly, they gave us something like 100 copies or maybe more of Microsoft Office.
Okay, which you could resell. We could resell or
use internally or do whatever we wanted with. As it happens, their product didn't last very long. So, and we carried on selling Ghostwriter. And then, of course, you know, DOS was going out the window and Windows was coming in the window, right? Yeah. So we had to redevelop Ghostwriter. But just before I do that, because I'm going to forget. I spoke about the Judastat product.
Yeah.
The other big product that was kind of one of our, really, it was one of our first enterprise level successes here in South Africa was this. We had developed Ghost Convey for lawyers. We had developed also a related product for producing home loan agreements used by the banks that were offering mortgages. Mm-hmm. So we figured that the third line in that triangle were the estate agents mm-hmm. in the whole property business. So we developed a product which we called APCS. I forget it was an acronym, and I don't even, but it was specifically a back office admin system for estate agents. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was based in Ghostwriter, so it handled all of the documentation, automated the documentation. That was our flagship offering, but it did estate agency admin. And the key thing is that with Ghost Mail, it enabled estate agents to do multi-listing, where they shared listings between each other. ABSA got wind of this. ABSA, newly formed ABSA, that had come out of, you reminded me the other day, I think it was it?
Allied, United, Foxcus.
Perm? Well, Perm came later.
Perm came later.
Yes. So MBS. There were four.
Was it MBS?
Yes, now Natal Building Society. Yes, I think so. There were four of them,
and then
Perm came later. Yeah.
Yeah.
So all these big building societies that were so much part of the ethos of South Africa.
Trust Bank.
Well done. Sorry. Well done. GCS.
Wasn't MBS.
No, it wasn't MBS. Mm. They might have come later as well.
I think MBS was bought by someone else.
Yeah. Anyway, here's Allied Banks of South Africa, ABSA, recently formed. Guy from ABSA called Tini van der Berg heard about our estate agency software and decided that's just what they needed. My wife and two sons and I had just gone on holiday to Umhlanga Rocks. We arrived there we had a 1 week timeshare. I think my in-laws had it and let us use it. We had arrived there from Johannesburg on the weekend. And on the Monday, we got a phone call from Tini van der Berg. I got a call from Mendel in Cape Town saying, Mark, we've got a problem. You have got to come home. I had to go to my wife and say, the holiday's cut short. We drove home on the Tuesday and went to go and negotiate with Tini van der Berg. They wanted to buy APCS from us. And it was a big transaction for us.
So the deal went through?
The deal went through. And I remember that the CTO at the time was a chap called Darby Berger. He took me to the top of the ABSA center in downtown Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. He said to me, you know, we've just inherited 25 buildings here in downtown Johannesburg, all these, the Perm and the Allied and the, you know. He said to me, maybe presciently, he says, I don't know whether to consider them assets or not, you know. I mean, downtown Johannesburg was a thriving commercial center in 1990-91. But anyway, they purchased APCS from us and contracted us to then spread APCS. We ended up being implemented in about 1,500 estate agency offices around the country. And in the Randburg offices of the data center here, just around the corner from where we are now at ABSA, we implemented this gigantic Novell-based WAN with hundreds of modems. And in fact, Novell sent engineers out from Utah, where they're based, to help us set it up, because it was one of the biggest implementations of Novell WANs that they had ever experienced. So it was, you know, it was a lovely project and it worked well. Today, it's Property 24, isn't it? You know, that's what it evolved to.
Right.
But in those days, the notion of a digital multi-listing service amongst the state agencies was so that was a lovely project.
Yeah.
So those were the Ghostwriter days.
Did Ghostwriter kind of fade a bit Microsoft Office took off?
No, it absolutely faded very quickly even because...
When Windows happened.
Yeah, Windows happened. So we sat down and said, what are we going to do next? And we created a second generation document automation was our thing, right?
Yeah.
We had this DOM. We had an understanding of how to automate documents. And so we developed still PC-based a product called Ghostfill. And that was actually an add-on to MS Word that did document automation.
Okay.
And And we were able to take many of those vertical apps that we had developed, and in particular Ghost Convey, and reignite it in Ghostful. We also went on to sell Ghostful as a standalone add-on for Word for document automation. Mm-hmm. We took it to the US and had quite a bit of success there, many thousands of users. So,
Okay. So
Ghostful became our second chapter in document automation. But around about that time, I just want to add one last thing relevant to, by this stage, we had pretty much stopped selling PCs. Commoditization of PC world is an obvious thing. Mm-hmm. But I do want to recognize David Kahn from Mesa, because he was mentioned, I think Duarte mentioned him.
Yes, well, in fact, we had Hein Engelbrecht.
Yeah, yes, CEO, that's
and
right.
Carlos Fiscaro.
I was with Carlos who spoke about it.
Who
yes, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, what a great guy David was. And and in the days when, of the first non-IBM formal PCs, he did amazing work. And we became one of his first vendors, actually.
Okay.
So we resold Mesa computers in that bundle with the attorney very successfully. And deep respect for David as well, as one of the legends that you spoke about. So nice time and lots of interaction with the same familiar names.
Yes.
The internet came along round about that time, okay? And we had done all of this work in using modems for data transfer. So it was a natural segue to internet. So what happened was that a couple of our staff came to us and said, look, there's this thing called the internet that just makes email and all sorts of other bits and pieces like that a whole lot simpler. There's a company in South Africa called Tixa, T-I-C-S-A. You remember Tixa? Mm. Chris Pinkham.
Yes.
And his group.
He went on to be intimately involved in Amazon.
He did. But before that, so we bought a line from Tixa. And I think at just about the same time, Dave Frankel and the Aptekers bought a line from Tixa.
Aha.
We went to Chris and his brother and a couple of others, and we said to them, listen, let's JV an internet company, retailing. So we started selling bandwidth on this line that we'd bought from them. Chris joined us, and we founded Internet Africa. So we kind of argue with Dave and them as to who was the first internet service provider. We had both bought a line from Tixa. Mm-hmm. Tixa folded into Internet Africa. Mm-hmm. And we started selling dial-up connections, it was so obviously a good commercial opportunity. We joke about this because my brother Daniel was very involved at the time, and we had said to him and one of the others in the firm, listen, if you can get 1,000 customers using this dial-up, not only will it be profitable, but we'll have a celebratory dinner. Well, we're still waiting for that celebratory dinner because we were just so busy and it just took off in front of us. And by the time we eventually sold it to Mweb sometime later, we were just shy of 100,000 dial-up subscribers and many fixed-line subscribers.
So what year was Internet Africa founded?
I think 74.
You mean 80?
No, I'm sorry, 1994. 94.
Same year as the election.
Yes.
First election.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. There, yeah. Okay. We had been buying modems from Datatech, from Jens Montanana. We came onto his radar.
Jens was known at the time for selling US robotics.
He had the US robotics franchise. Exactly that. And we were buying US robotics modems and building these big banks. In those days, they were actually hardcore modem. Later on, they became cards that went into the PCs.
Right.
And we were buying lines from Telkom faster than they could supply them, of course. But we had these modem centers, especially in Cape Town and Johannesburg. And Jens Montanana saw this. He had invested in Pipex, an internet provider from the UK.
I remember them.
He approached us to buy Internet Africa. He had the connection with UUNET out of the States, and it was initially called UUNET Internet Africa.
Mm.
Later on, the UUNET side of things, there was that incident with WorldCom and
the fraud.
Yeah, exactly. Bernie Ebert. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So we fortunately, our timing was right because we skirted past that.
Mm-hmm.
We became Internet Africa and we were in full scale competition with Dave and the aptiekers and, yes. And you know, competition, but with lots of mutual respect. Mm-hmm. Fantastic guys. They were amazing. And it was nice to hear David tell his side of things a few weeks back. I'm still in close touch with him.
He's done incredibly well.
He's done really well, and he's just a pleasure. Fantastic guy.
Lovely guy.
Really. Yeah. So it was another exciting chapter. You know, you can imagine, I think the energy, and Duncan, you were around then. Mm-hmm. You saw it. So you referred to that
episode. I'd like to spend some time talking about that, because it's a fascinating slice of South Africa's internet history.
It is, yeah.
But Telkom... the government had just sold, I think it was 30% of Telkom to a consortium that was made up of Telekom Malaysia.
Yes.
And I think they had the minority of that stake.
Yes.
There was a consortium called Tintana, which bought the 30%
stake. I'd forgotten that, but yes. And then the US.
And I think effectively Telekom Malaysia ended up with 12%. And AT&T, or SBC as it was known at the time, ended up with 18%.
Okay.
And they then... the clauses of that agreement gave them a lot of control over Telkom and management positions and all of that sort of thing. And they decided that this exclusivity period that the government had granted to them didn't only deal with fixed lines, but also extended to the provision of internet services.
Yes.
And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, they tried to claim that the internet protocol itself
belonged to
them as a service that could be provided into the market.
Quite right.
When Telkom started... or Telkom's foreign shareholders started flexing their muscles in this way, what was your first reaction?
Look, first of all, we were young. We had good engineers on our side. We were energized. And the whole internet fever was exploding around the world. So I don't think we took them seriously initially. You know, we were building a network based on Telkom lines that they were providing. And we were ordering these lines faster than they could provide them. And they continued providing them even as this war evolved, right? Mm-hmm. So in the early days, South Africa was one of the advanced countries in the world, actually, in terms of internet, the promulgation of internet.
Yes.
And I think, I can remember us going to the computer fair at NASREC, with our internet bundles, selling our internet bundles. And I remember amusingly, people used to come up to our stand at NASREC, the Internet Africa stand. The prevailing question then from many of them was, listen, who owns the internet? You know, people didn't understand that it could be what it is, you know, democratizing basically the movement of data around the world. So for us, it was anathema for Telkom to even believe that they had a monopoly right to the internet protocol. Once they started indicating that they were serious about it, and the new CEO from Telkom was
Tom Barry, the chief operating officer.
Yes.
Who was appointed, I think Sizwe Ntsasana was still the group CEO.
Yeah, that's correct. He was group CEO, but
Tom Barry was really running things.
Tom was the guy.
Mm.
So he contacted us, you know, and said, look, we're going to take you on. We are going to stop you. So that was when we found
you up.
Yeah. And Internet Solution. We formed ISPA, the Internet Service Provider Association. And by the way, you know, Internet Solutions and Internet Africa, we were, it's probably fair to say we were the largest of the of the ISPs, but there were many other very good ISPs trading, so maybe half a dozen, maybe a few more. Mm-hmm. I think of people like Anthony Brooks and others, and I should remember the other names because it was an amazing team
of people. DataPro, were they around then?
DataPro were there. If I spend some time thinking about it, I'll get some more names, and I should. But anyway, we all met informally initially, but it was clear that we needed to have a united front against Telkom because they were serious about it. So we created ISPA, and... Dave and I were voted as co-chairs of ISPA. Dave spoke about this because we went to the Competition Commission.
That's right.
Yeah, and we took good legal counsel, serious legal counsel. I think Telkom were amazed that we, you know, that they'd had to go to the Competition Commission because they just felt they had the right. But you know, there was this. It was. I don't know if they were conflicted or not because they were doing good business. Excellent business through us. We had become fantastic first-tier customers of theirs. But they were trying to close us down. So, you know, it didn't really fit so well. But anyway, Tom eventually called. We went to his office. And you'll remember this because you wrote an article on this. First of all, by the way, we walked in, Dave and I, it was the two of us. Yeah. And I'll never forget this because he tried to bully us and tried to intimidate us.
Oh, well, that was in his nature, I remember him clearly.
So I think I was a bit intimidated. Dave wasn't, you know? To be perfectly honest. But he did say, I'll never forget it. He said, you know, again, in an American drawl, and I do a lot of business in America. I'm very happy to do business in America with this. He said, I'm from Texas, and in Texas, we're quite accustomed to going to war, he said to me, us. He said, and actually, we usually win. So if you guys want to take us on, then we'll declare a war, he said.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure Dave will remember that. But later on, as we went through the machinations of all of this, at some point in time, I think they realized that they were on the wrong side of history and the wrong side of the dynamics of what was happening anyway. So we brokered detente, right?
Okay.
And you wrote an article in the FM. There was a cover picture of Tom standing between Dave and I, sort of shaking hands mutually.
Yes, you came to Rosebank. I think we were in the Rosebank building, and three of you were there.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, and I think that was pretty much the end of it. Yeah. They were never going to win that battle, right? Maybe they realized it, and eventually they launched their own ISP.
But it dragged on for a long time.
It did drag on. Oh, for a couple of years, actually. Mm-hmm. No, it wasn't.
And it never went to court?
No.
There were lawsuits there?
But they were withdrawn. There were attempts from them, cease and desist letters. And there was, we had to go before the Competition Commission.
And Competition Board, I'm really digging into history, into my mind's history here. Pierre Brooks?
Gosh. Pierre Brooks? It was Pierre Brooks.
At the Competition Board?
Quite right. Yeah. Well done, Duncan. There was Andrew Smith was also there as well.
Oh, Smith. Yeah. He went on to Data Tech.
That's right. That's where I met Andrew at Data Tech, yeah.
Right.
So, you know, by that stage, and I think I might have mentioned this, Compustat was now part of Data Tech, right? Because Jens had bought Internet Africa. Mm. 1996. So Internet Solutions were obviously
they were cozying up to Dimension Data.
They had gone to DD, that's right, and we had gone to Data Tech. Jens, when he bought Internet Africa, he kept us on to run it, but we had Compustat as well with Ghost Convey and all of the other products. And so a year later, so I think Internet Africa was Data Tech's first acquisition, and the rest of Compustat became their third acquisition.
Okay.
We were in Data Tech until we did a buyout from them in 1998. But I'll come to that in a moment. Once Telkom realized that the game, you know, the game was up, the internet flourished beautifully in those early days. ISPA played a role because apart from having spearheaded the fight against Telkom, there was other work for us to do. Mm-hmm. You know, we created these switches, the exchanges for data, and that was important, and it was moderated by ISPA.
Oh, the Johannesburg Internet Exchange, the Cape Town.
Exactly, yeah. And those still exist, and ISPA still exists and does good work, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one other.
There was a guy, before you carry on, there was another guy, I think you've mentioned his name already earlier in this discussion, and Anthony Brooks.
Yes.
He was intimately involved with ISPA.
Yes.
And he was actually one of the guys. He was always behind the scenes, but he was intimately involved.
So you couldn't have characterized it better. But I had a lot of time and respect for Anthony. He was marvelous. I've lost contact with him.
Me too.
Gee, he was a good guy, you know. And he was really, he understood the internet very well. And he understood what was happening. Mm-hmm. But I think he just didn't want to be the front man.
Yeah.
And that's why I think that the group that he was with asked David and I to co-chair ISPA. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is that the engine room was Anthony. Mm-hmm. And some of his colleagues whose names I don't remember to my discredit, because there were some good guys there.
Yeah. So
I wanted to give you one other little anecdote, because I saw you podcast you did with Ivan Epstein, right?
Yes.
From Softline.
Yes.
So we had a chapter with them as well, a nice chapter, you know, and they were good guys too, you know. So the story there is that, you know, we were selling more of the B2C side of things, the dial-up side of it. So, but in those days, to get to the customer base, typically through a retail outlet, you needed a box and of software. You know, you used to go into the shops, if you remember, and buy MS Word or MS Office in a box, right? Yeah. You know, the problem was, what do you put in a box that is really only selling an internet connection? You could put Netscape on the, you know, and talk about that. You have CD-ROM, but there was no real software to sell. You know, there's a voucher saying dial up on your computer. So we put a bit of software in there, which was a connection, which people would put in. But then to subscribe to Internet Africa, they would do that online. We wrote software to enable them to subscribe online. So we would, you know, and I think it was 100 rand a month. That was the cost there. So we gave that away to in the Incredible Connections of this world as the first month. The customers would come in, pay 100 or 200, whatever it was, to get this box and get their first month free, or having bought the box. But it was our touch point to customers.
Yes.
And I went to see Ivan, who, you know, they had a lot of experience in retailing and and selling retail. They were selling Pascal, by the way, and even in boxes. Yeah. Exactly. And so they helped us quite a lot in to get a retail presence into the marketplace. And there was another nice piece to it. Around about that time, I got a call from a lady called Janine Marcus, who was the wife of David Marcus, who was head of Brian Marcus, who was head of Microsoft, actually, here in South Africa. Later they went off to Seattle, to Microsoft headquarters. But she had written a book on how to use Internet Explorer.
Okay.
Because people didn't know how to use Internet. And Microsoft, I don't know if you remember when Bill Gates came here.
I do.
And he spoke at Gallagher States, right? Remember that? Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying that he thought Internet Explorer was going to do well, because he used the expression, he said, "We've priced it to go," because it was free, right?
Yeah.
And that was one of the lawsuits that they faced, because they were held up in antitrust against Netscape, right? But anyway, so she wrote a book on how to use Internet Explorer, and she wanted to know if we would include it in our sales to our internet users. So that became something we could put in the box. You know, that book.
The M-Web Big Black Box that came later, bundled Arthur Goldstuck's book.
Correct. The Hitchhiker's Guide.
Were they copying you guys?
No, well, I'll tell you what happened there. So that's a nice story too, because there we worked with Antoni Roux. Hey?
Antoni Roux
ran
M-Web back in those days. There were a bunch of ISPs, actually, that kind of came together under the M-Web banner.
Yeah, they were buying in those.
They were buying. It was Global. Was it Global?
Yes, Global was the other one, big one, right?
And then there was another one, World Online. I think that was also bought by
Duncan. You're very good. Your memory is better than mine. Yes,
I don't know where I'm pulling this from.
It was World Online. Yes,
that was a guy called Graham Victor who was running that. I think Vodacom was an investor in that.
Well, I'll tell you about Graham Victor. So I'm not sure about the World Online, but Graham Victor today is my son's father-in-law. My son Joshua is married to his daughter Daniela.
Oh, okay.
And I had a lot of respect, and I worked with Graham quite a lot. And he eventually, he was head of Computicket in the early days.
Yes, that's right.
And then he went to Vodacom, and he worked with Joan Joffe a lot at Vodacom. Mm. So I see him regularly now, by the way. So that's another nice story. But anyway.
I was going to say, Antoni Roux came out of the Naspers stable.
Yes.
He was running M-Web for a while. He went on later to find the Tencent investment for Naspers, which transformed the business into what it is today.
Exactly right. Listen, Antoni was fantastic. Another one of these visionaries and another legend, Chamonix. He passed away.
Very young.
Yeah, very young. But I worked closely with him because what happened was in right about, I think, 98, 99, Datatec decided, it was kind of the dot-com burst after the dot-com bubble, And Jens and others decided to go back to their roots, which was hardware distribution, and they sold off. So first of all, my colleagues, Mendel, myself, Roland, we did an MBO, a management buyout of what used to be Compustat. Mm-hmm. And we reestablished ourselves as Corby Tech. Talk about that in a moment. But the more significant transaction at the time, at least certainly for data tech anyway, was that they sold off Internet Africa to Naspers as MWeb. So MWeb was still very much part of the Naspers stable.
MWeb was around at that time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. They had just
sold. So they were bulking up.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And gosh, that negotiation, I sat in offices together with Antoni and others for months at the attorney's offices in Long Street in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a straightforward negotiation. It was a competitive one, and there were times when it was on and off. Mm-hmm. And Tony introduced me to the term seagulls. He used to refer to Koos Becker and Jens Montanon as seagulls because they would drop in every now and again, poop on us, basically, and then fly off and leave us to conclude the negotiation, you know. It was eventually done. And having worked closely and become good friends with Antoni, and there was a lot of mutual respect, he asked me to stay on with him during the migration. Mm-hmm. It was an informal arrangement, but I worked together with him during the migration. And it was in that period that we spoke about the boxes, and he decided to have the big black box as a kind of an equivalent to the old Internet Africa boxes.
Yeah,
and it was part of what they did, you know.
Okay. So That business has changed hands so many times.
It's now part of Internet Solutions.
Is it still part of Internet Solutions?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, the brand is still there.
No, it's not. It was sold to Web Africa last year.
Right? Sorry. Last year or the year before. Out of Internet Solutions
to Web Africa.
There you go.
Yeah. So it really, every five years, it's got a new owner.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah. But quite a bit of history.
Yeah,
there.
Lovely history.
So after Internet Africa was sold, you went back to your roots in a way as well.
Right.
Back to the software business.
Right.
How did it emerge over the...
So we relaunched ourselves independently as Corby Tech. We were selling Ghostful quite actively. And it was the same crew, you know, same people that had been with us even since the 80s and 70s, many of them. And we sought opportunities. We decided, we funded it ourselves. I think I might have mentioned that, you know, we never took on any VC funding at all. So mm-hmm. we've been self-funded through all of this.
Right from the beginning.
And you know, I suppose we're serial entrepreneurs, I guess.
Yeah.
We've had fun, you know, and we've lived through a pioneering era in the world of computing. When we started...
Yes.
When we started, there was no such thing as computer science at university. There was no course mm-hmm. of computer science. People taught themselves programming. You know? So Corby Tech, document automation was still our strength. And we had Ghostful. And we were selling it as a standalone product. And we had it in Convey, and as I mentioned. And we looked for other opportunities. A very nice chapter that happened quite soon after we had done this, so early 2000, was we heard of an RFP, a request for proposal, that had been put out by the American Institute of Architects in the US for a document automation product. And we bid. There were 62 bidders over a period of almost a year. And then finally in August 2002, or July 2002, we were informed that we were one of two. It was us and a company called Hot Docs out of Utah in the US. And we went to pitch. In the AIA is the professional body that oversees the architecture and construction industry in the US. And they have this body of documents, about 130 contract documents, that they wanted to offer digitally. Mm-hmm. So up until that time, they were selling them in pads, much the way you used to be able to go into the CNA and get contract of, you know, wills and mm-hmm. they used to sell these construction industry contracts in printed version where people would fill them in. And they wanted to automate it. And so we bid for this. They in a in a heritage building right next door to the White House. It's the next door building to the White House in Washington, D.C. Oh, wow. Yeah. So I went there in July. We made our third pitch to them in a panel that was arranged in a kind of a UN-style horseshoe around. It was an amazing experience, you know. Amongst other things, we were asked the question of our diversity, 2002. So we had anticipated that. We had done some homework, and I gave them the stats on our diversity, firstly in terms of the mix of people of different color in our organization, but also male-female. Mm-hmm. As it happens, we were about 50-50. And I'll never forget that one of the adjudicators on the panel was an engineer, senior engineer from Autodesk. They produced AutoCAD software, which was the standard drafting software in the architecture industry, AutoCAD. Mm-hmm. A big firm out of the U.S. And I remember him turning around to the panel at the time when I gave them the stats, saying, he said, I don't think there's a software company in the U.S. that has diversity stats as good as these. So it was a proud moment as a South African company that we could win substantial business. So we did. We ended up winning that contract.
You've done well in the U.S.
Yeah, so we have. We have. It's been a happy hunting ground for us. Yeah. In the end, there were about 36,000 users of this AIA product that we partnered with the AIA to sell into the U.S. Mm-hmm. That led on to us selling more document automation software. That was a document automation product. In the early 2000s, Ghostful had seen its time as a PC-based product, and we needed to redevelop document automation into our third-generation product, which we called Ghost Draft. And that's an enterprise SaaS-based product that we sell now. And to your point, we sell it intensively and extensively in the U.S.
You have an office there.
We have got an office. Well, actually, we've got a bunch of employees who work from home. Yes, across mostly the West Coast, but we sell throughout the U.S. And, you know, I'm proud to say we've got close on 90 large insurance companies, mainly a couple of banks, that use Ghost Draft as their document automation product. To automate the production of policies and legal agreements and correspondence and claims and so on. So that's actually now the bulk of what we sell. Mm-hmm. We did have one, gosh, Duncan, I'm really pushing these things. We had two other products that we sold last year to a Canadian firm, by the way. So one also in the document automation space was called ACL, Automated Civil Litigation, which was a product for handling court forms in Canada. Mm-hmm. And we ended up selling that to over 400 law firms in Canada, all using the Ghostful and the Ghost Draft engine as the basis for automating the production of litigation documents in the legal fraternity. Going back to law, which was where we kind of started, you know, in Canada. And then as the other product that we had was kind of peripheral to that was a legal practice management suite called Ghost Practice. Mm-hmm. And that's still in use today here in South Africa, I think over 500 law firms and in Canada as well. Last year, we were approached by a listed company out of Toronto called Dye & Durham, who specialize in legal software. And they entered into a transaction with us and bought both of those businesses. Mm-hmm. So they now have an office here in South Africa. So again, you know, the ability to do business with North American corporates is something that we're proud of and that we've been successful in doing. So
you've always remained a Cape Town-based company. Did you ever think at any time of relocating to America?
Yeah, good question. Short answer is no.
No.
You know, we're happy where we are. You know, America's been good to us and we've enjoyed doing business there. And we've made good friends. Jim Dinniger was the COO of the American Institute of Architects. And I'll tell you another little anecdote. When we won that contract, he said he needed to come out here. Look, they were a very conservative organization. You know, this is the professional body of architects. So he needed, as he said, to come and make sure that we were who we said we were. So he came to Cape Town in 2002, August. And on our recommendation, he stayed at the Vineyard Hotel, which is down the road from our offices. Mm-hmm. That month coincided with, I don't know if you remember this, there was an attack on the Rand short-lived attack on the rand. The rand had been trading, if I remember correctly, at around 4 rand to the dollar or thereabouts.
Which year was this?
82.
88.
No, sorry. Let me get this right. Sorry. 2002.
2002.
It was a year after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
Because the AIA offices were right next door to the White House. They were still in 9/11. It was part of their psyche.
Oh, the war was spinning up in
Iraq.
That's
right. Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Anyway, August 02, there was an attack on the rand, and almost overnight, my numbers won't be in, but it went from around 4 rand to the dollar to 10 or 12 rand of the dollar temporarily, and then reality struck and went back.
I think, right? I remember that.
Now, Jim Dinegar happened to come and stay at the Vineyard Hotel during that week or two or three or he said to me he couldn't believe, because there's a brilliant restaurant. He said one of the best meals he'd ever had in his life there.
It cost him nothing.
Yeah, he said it cost him $30. He couldn't understand how that was possible with oysters and wine and champagne. He said, anyway, whoever it was, it cemented the notion that we were a good company for them to invest in. So it worked in our favor.
Yeah.
And we had a 20-year relationship with them, you know. So, yeah, and by the way, you know, they had no qualms in doing business with us as a South African company. And we don't hide the fact that Ghost Draft is developed in South Africa. We market it out of the U.S., and we have a U.S. entity that does that. We sell and market it. But we're proud of the fact that we're Cape Town based.
And you did another deal with Naspers, didn't you? 2009, I think.
Yeah, so 2009, Naspers bought from us. They bought Ghost Convey. Oh, there was another product that I should have mentioned. Is we had developed this deeds office search product called WinDeed. That's also very widely used by anybody who's looking for information, basically online information. Because it was a fledgling company that we bought in and built up that did searching, online real-time searching into the deeds office and into the government SIPSI, the company, the corporate office, and others, for data that was needed in the conveyancing transaction. So this fitted where Naspers were going. So 2009, they bought those businesses from Corbitech,
mm-hmm.
Convey and WinDeed. And at the time, they had a dormant business called Property 24.
Mm-hmm.
So they threw that into the mix because it was a natural part of property, gave it to us to develop. So we built up Property 24. We continued to build up Convey and WinDeed. Very successfully inside, we were a subsidiary. Corbitech became a subsidiary of Naspers.
Okay.
In 2009.
Oh, they bought the whole business.
They bought the whole business, mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
We kept out of it Ghost Draft, and we kept out of it Ghost Practice and ACL, the ones that I mentioned. We ran those separately, but they bought Corbitech, ran it for about 6 years, and in 2015, they were approached by LexisNexis to purchase those businesses. Naspers elected to keep Property 24. They still own Property 24, but effectively sold Corbitech minus Property 24 to LexisNexis,
mm-hmm.
who run it today. And so we reconstituted, we juggled with our name, we called ourselves Corbicom,
mm-hmm.
And we had, you know, Ghost Draft, ACL, Ghost Practice in there. So that was a second chapter in Naspers, you're right,
yeah.
For us.
And the business is Corbicom today, is it?
So, it's actually Corbistat.
Corbistat.
Because, and we decided that there was some synergy in that because we were Compustat, right?
Yes.
And we were the Corby group for a long time, so Corbistat. And the reason for that was just last year when Dye & Durham bought ACL and Ghost Practice from us, from Canada, mm-hmm. they also bought the business. So they bought Corbicom. And
you
so,
must be
so we had
expert,
to tweak the names.
But you're very seasoned when it comes to M&A.
Well, that's why I'm so great. And I have to tell you, you know, I'm still very much in the trenches working with customers and the software. Mm-hmm. And I have to credit my business partners, Mendel and mm-hmm. others. Mervyn Golden is our CFO. I mentioned also Richard Newton and Wayne Toms. They were at a company called UCS. I don't know.
Retail tech.
Exactly. Affinity Bright. Logic. Yes, exactly. Mm. So those two are now with us. Mm-hmm. And Richard and Mendel and Mervyn Golden, our CFO, really have spearheaded most of the M&A work that we've done. But yeah, we've negotiated many.
Okay.
But isn't that what entrepreneurs do?
Yeah.
You know. It's interesting because I think I said to you, we never use the word startup, but I guess we had lots of startups.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, I haven't mentioned the failures. We had many, many failures along the way. But, you know, so what? That's part of the fun of the fair, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we've enjoyed ourselves.
So you're still going to the office every day?
Mm.
You're still committed to this business?
I love it.
Are you just going to carry on, or do you retire at some point?
My wife said she doesn't want to have to make lunch for me. So, no, I'm not.
No plans to retire.
I'm very fortunate. Gee whiz, what a privilege to still be able to come into the office and be tolerated there and make a difference and be part of the team.
Yeah,
and Mendel's got some amazing, and Mendel also.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah.
So many years to go.
Well, hopefully, Duncan. So,
Mark Todes is without doubt one of the legends of the local IT industry. It's been fascinating.
Fantastic
chatting with you, and thank you for so much for sharing your story and some of the amazing anecdotes about
Duncan. Thank you for giving me that chance. You know, I've enjoyed having to remember so many of these chapters and relive them through being able to talk to you. So, you know, I think you yourself have played your very important role in the technology history of this country. You know, you've seen it from the journalist's point of view.
Yeah.
It must have been equally fascinating for
you. It has been.
I'm sure you've got many of similar anecdotes.
Fantastic. Right. Fantastic. Yeah. Mark Todes, thank you for making the time.
Thank you.